are going to discuss the history of liberalism in America and its effect on politics and policies today. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, April the 16th. We will welcome in the author of the new book, The Cause: The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. And we'll welcome your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. We'll wonder if you think President Obama is a liberal, and is he the same kind of liberal that Franklin Roosevelt was? Has liberal become a dirty word? We'll welcome your thoughts and questions as to whether or not liberalism is on its way back or not. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Eric Alterman is author of The Cause: The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, the Nation Institute, and the World Policy Institute. He's also a distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College and CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, and a columnist for The Nation and a regular contributor to The Beast. And he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Morning.
So we're all starting on the same page. How do you define American liberalism?
Well, liberalism has really gone through, three stages in its history in the United States. The first one was with the founding of the United States, which was founded, it's the first nation ever founded on liberal principles. Classical liberal principles, which are just the principles of the Enlightenment, freedom of religion, freedom of thought, freedom for men and women to decide how they want to organize themselves. This was new back then. You know, everything before that, not everything, but all great states before that had been organized according to either churchly or royal edicts. The second stage began with the New Deal, when Franklin Roosevelt decided that, and this is not Roosevelt himself, the idea had obviously been bubbling for decades, that one needed to put the government on the side of the common man and woman, because the forces of big business and other organized forces were too much for any individual to take on by themselves. So working people began for the first time to look to their government, the federal government, to equalize the battles that they faced. And then the third phase began, again, these dates are rough, but it began in the 1960s when first blacks and then women and then later gays and handicapped people and Hispanics and a lot of other people decided that they were tired of accepting the traditional discrimination they had experienced, and they decided they wanted to use the government to address that with the manners, various manners in which they felt discriminated against. And that became the cultural liberal agenda. And that's where we are today. In fact, I argue that the cultural liberal agenda has overtaken the first two agendas, and that hasn't been such a great thing for liberalism, but here we are.
Yeah, why did the cultural liberalism take over from the what sounds like an economic liberalism of FDR?
Well, it's a good question, and it's got a long answer. One reason is that people tend to identify in these countries ethnically, sexually, by race, by religion, and not so much by class. And so it's very easy to get people together on the basis of their what they consider to be their primary identities, and not so easy to get them to join together with people of different identities. So liberals have tended to fight amongst themselves for the spoils of government rather than joining together to enlarge the pie, as conservatives do much better than they do. Secondly, cultural liberalism doesn't cost anything. So rich people who are cultural liberals, and many rich people are, They embrace a cultural liberal agenda, gay marriage, reproductive rights, immigration, particularly. Rich people really like immigration. These things are consistent with their values, but that doesn't mean they have to pay higher taxes. So as our political system has become increasingly dependent on rich people to fund campaigns, these people have become more and more powerful. At the same time, labor unions have become weaker and weaker, and labor unions were one of the main ways in which different cultural identities were knit together. So those identities have become weaker, and these have become much stronger. Those are the two main reasons, I would say.
All right. So, and you're saying that this focus on cultural liberalism is bad for liberalism.
Well, it's a loser. It pits liberalism's constituencies against one another, and it allows conservatives to say that liberals only care about paying off their people who are liberals, like economic elites and professors and lazy people who want handouts and so forth. And what liberalism really needs to work is an expanding economic pie. It doesn't work well in times of economic contraction because people want to hold on to what they have and are nervous, and they tend to vote their fears rather than their hopes. So I am a cultural liberal, but I think that the cultural liberal agenda has to be secondary to the economic liberal agenda, and we've had the reverse since the 1960s.
Is that changing a little bit, though, today, and the rhetoric we're hearing on the campaign trail, at least when it comes to, for instance, tax the rich?
Well, if you believe the rhetoric you hear on the campaign trail, maybe it is, but I believed it in 2008, and I'm not going to make that mistake again today.
But talk a little bit more about that. I mean, President Obama all last week was calling for the Buffett rule and increasing taxes on millionaires. You think that's all talk, no action, or what?
I think talk is very cheap. And I think I can quote you a lot of things that President Obama said in 2008, particularly with regard to his promised agenda, that he apparently didn't mean, or at least he didn't mean them hard enough, mean them enough to fight for them. I think it would be a great idea if he did embrace an economic agenda. I argued for this in an article I wrote in the New York Times last week. It's what Franklin Roosevelt did. He was quite conservative in his first term and then became much more radical on the economic side after he was reelected. But you can only fool me once.
Well, why are you so disappointed in President Obama's support for liberal causes?
Well, because I don't think he's fought for them. I think every time he's met concerted opposition, he's given into it. He's allowed the crazy is not a nice word, but he's allowed the radicalism of the Tea Party, Republican Party, to determine the shape and scope of the agenda, instead of fighting over the shape of that agenda. When he ran for president, Barack Obama cited Ronald Reagan as someone he admired for the way that he managed to shape the discourse and inject new ideas into our politics. And he got some flack from it, from Hillary Clinton, because she pretended he was saying that he actually just admired Ronald Reagan, which he wasn't. And he's done nothing like that. Instead, he's just played the hand that was dealt him. And it's been a quite conservative hand. It's been more conservative than Richard Nixon, by far.
So President Obama is, in your view, not liberal at all?
No, I think he is liberal. I think he doesn't fight for what he believes in. I'm not sure that he actually believes in these things. I think he takes the shape of whatever environment he's in. And Washington right now is a very conservative environment that's ruled by money, and he's decided to make the best deal he can with it. He may be right. I may be wrong. I think he should fight to try and open up some space for the liberal policies that he campaigned on, but he doesn't think that.
What do you mean by the fight for American liberalism?
What do I mean?
Why does there have to be a fight for it?
Well, because if no one fights for it, it won't win.
Well, the conservatives did seem to win in 2010, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, why is that? I mean, is it that particular ideology is that this country is more conservative now than it used to be?
I don't think the country is more conservative. I think the political system is more conservative. That's in part because of money is much more important than votes are. That's number one. Number two, I think that the political class is much more conservative than people are. I think polls remain pretty liberal, but people don't have any real say in the system, except once every 2 or 4 years, by which time most of the important questions have already been determined for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, what if you were President Obama's advisor, what would you advise him to do when it comes to liberalism?
I would advise him to fight for the things that he promised in his campaign, and I would advise him to take on the President Obama, he refuses to recognize that he has any enemy. He refuses to, he's trying to put himself above the fray. And at the same time, the right is conducting an incredibly vicious class war against the poor and the middle class. And he sees himself as kind of the referee. You know, it's not even the 1% against the 99%. It's the 1% of the 1%. And he says, well, we have to tax them more because it's math. But he should say, no, we have to tax them more because it's fair. What they're doing to the country is unfair. And he won't say that. He doesn't want to be perceived as taking one side or another. So there's only one side being fought for.
So who was the last president to fight for liberal causes? Was it FDR?
No. Harry Truman did. Lyndon Johnson did. John Kennedy did. Not exclusively. They did some conservative things, too. But they fought for liberal causes. Bill Clinton was much more conservative than Jimmy Carter, and Bill Clinton sort of began the transition into Democratic presidents being as conservative as they were liberal.
So how do you see the 2012 election playing out?
Well, you know, I'm a historian. I'm not a mystic. Most people think that if the economy stays improving, then there's no question Obama will probably be reelected. If the economic recovery is interrupted, then Romney will probably win. And nobody knows the future as to what will actually happen there.
We're talking with Eric Alterman. He is author of The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. We welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What do you think about the history and the future of liberalism? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you join us tomorrow at this time. It's another edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley will be back to answer your personal finance questions tomorrow at this time, every Tuesday at this time. We are talking about the history and the future of liberalism with Eric Alterman, who is author of The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question for him, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let's take calls. We have full lines. Lou in Cudahy is with us. Hello, Lou.
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
One of the drum chants of the left is fairness, tolerance, and compassion. And I wondered how fair the guest thinks it is when 47 million Americans don't pay federal income tax, so that the rest of the population, that is the middle class, have to hump that burden of spending up the mountain. We become pack animals, don't we?
What do you say to that, Eric?
Well, the gentleman is saying that that poor people making under a certain minimum amount, don't pay taxes. It's not true. They don't pay federal taxes, but they do pay state taxes, they pay sales taxes, they pay all kinds of taxes. you know, it's a matter of values. I'm perfectly fine with that. If someone, you know, if someone is struggling economically and we decide that we'd rather have people who aren't struggling carry the burden, I'm totally cool with that. I'm much more interested in the fact that, say, the Exxon Corporation and 30 other billion-dollar corporations didn't pay any taxes last year. I'm more interested in the fact that hedge fund managers, because of the way they've been able to manipulate the tax code, can make billions of dollars and yet pay a much lower tax rate than I do. So it's a matter of values. It doesn't bother me. It bothers him. That's fine. It's cool to disagree in this country.
Yeah, thanks for the call. What do you say about Mitt Romney when it became clear that he was most likely going to be the GOP presidential nominee, kind of setting the stage that he said there's this very clear choice between Republicans or President Obama, who he painted as somebody that was going to was for big government and for entitlements, and big government will take care of you, and really painting it in a negative light. And on the other hand, he said he was going to be, you know, providing a great opportunity for growth for everybody with his thoughts for free market. I mean, he was really dissing liberalism when he made that speech.
You know, you can measure these things. You can measure the size of government. There's a certain amount of government, a very small amount, that is discretionary. After you take out the debt and the military and the entitlement payments, under Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton, it went down from about 5% of the budget to about 3%. Okay, under Barack Obama's current budget, it's 1.8%. He's one of the most conservative presidents we've ever had in terms of spending policy. The stock market has done incredibly well under Barack Obama. And the economy has grown under Democratic presidents to a far more consistent degree than it has under Republican presidents. So what Mitt Romney is basically making is an ideological argument, saying conservative ideology is simply preferable to non-conservative ideology. Because, again, it's a mistake to call Barack Obama a liberal, much less a socialist, in terms of the way he governs. And some people feel that way. What I object to is the idea that it's necessarily true, that small government is necessarily better. It's not true. It's just a matter of preference. But our media and our political class treated it as if it's true. And that's one of the great failures of liberalism, that they've allowed this to happen, that liberals have allowed this to happen.
Austin in Milwaukee. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. It's very interesting to me that we are still using the term liberalism, considering that we've had people who self-identify as conservative who ascribe to neoliberalism, which is a very similar philosophy to Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and other Democrats. Ronald Reagan, for example, practiced neoliberalism, and Milton Friedman, who's an economist, promoted liberalism. So the term liberalism itself is very fallacious. And in fact, the myth that FDR was somehow on the progressive side economically, it was only possible by movements in the streets, people demanding and forcing the Democratic Party at that time to do something about the massive unemployment. And so I guess my question is, that at what point do we, as people on the left side of the political spectrum, stop feeding this myth and break away from the Democratic Party, which has proven its alliance with the 1%? We're starting tomorrow on tax day. We have a protest at the Milwaukee Chamber of Commerce at 6 o'clock. Come out and join us if you're ready for that.
Well, thanks for the call. Austin, what do you think of Professor Altman?
Well, liberalism has enemies on the right, on the left, as well as on the right, and you just heard one of them. I think it's a mistake for people to the left of liberals to attack liberals. I think they should look to liberals as their allies. This gentleman says that liberals are basically useless and that Franklin Roosevelt was no good, and And it's, you know, the United States is not poised for a Marxist revolution. The only progress that's ever made to help the poor and the disadvantaged and the disenfranchised in the United States is done gradually through reform and through coalition. So, you know, I would be out. I live in New York, but I would be out at a demonstration to support, you know, let's say the teachers in Wisconsin. I'd be happy to, but I wouldn't be out there under the banner of groups that attack liberalism and think that liberals are the enemy. That's what Vladimir Ilyich Lenin termed an infantile left-wing disorder. He was talking about the anarchists, and he was, of course, a communist, but you see it in this country as well.
Yeah, so was Austin, though, correct that that FDR didn't push for New Deal type of programs until the people sick of the unemployment demanded it?
No. You know, he doesn't know why FDR pushed for the programs any more than I do. He's not FDR. He's not in his mind. He likes to tell a story that gives all of the responsibility to the quote-unquote people, but it's obviously much more complicated than that. A lot of things had to happen. Big business had to play a role. I mean, you know, all different kinds of labor unions played a role. FDR's brain trust played a big role, and those people were liberals. So definitely the people were very important in the New Deal, the demonstrations and so forth. I don't want to diss them. I admire people who organize politically and use the system the way it's supposed to be used. But to just say that this is why X happened is ahistorical, and I'm a historian. I can't buy it.
On Facebook, Boyd writes, I would say Obama is a liberal, though he has had a difficult time getting things passed due to all the money in Washington. If you look at health care, for instance, I do not think Obama wanted to go with a public option, but with a single-payer plan like Canada and Europe. Unfortunately, due to special interests, he had to settle for something less, and yet that was still too much for many in this country. Does Boyd have it right?
No, because it's not this country that decided it. It's the Congress and the press. And the press, as I said, the Congress are much more conservative than the country, in large measure because of the power of money and the power of conservative ideology that operates in both. So we don't know what the country thought, and the country doesn't really know what it thought because the issue is too complicated. The health care bill was almost 3,000 pages. All we know is what ended up happening in a system that was determined by the interests like the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry and the insurance industry and not, quote-unquote, the country.
Julie in Duluth, Minnesota is with us. Hello, Julie.
Good morning. With all due respect to Eric Alderman, I've read him for years in The Nation, and I appreciate his perspective. I do think it's important to understand that President Obama accomplished a great deal on behalf of people who do not have a voice. And he did that by facing opposition. I mean, Eric Cantor and, Boehner and the rest of them, they really have worked overtime, as they did with Clinton, to discredit him and to slur him. And I frankly think it's remarkable that with the really persistent and relentless opposition that he has faced, he has remained cool, calm, collected, practical, and realistic in accomplishing, as I say, things for people who don't have a voice. I mean, alone, the unbelievable economic mess which he inherited from Bush, and the Republican Party has been extraordinarily effective in working to eradicate that from the public consciousness as if it almost didn't happen. I mean, the Republican, and I will say machine, is very, very effective in their communication strategy to not only eradicate the damage Bush has done with his wars, which were off the budget in his administration, but to somehow heap the responsibility and the negative effects of Bush's policies on Obama. And so when you say, I just want to finish one thing, when you say the public doesn't know, the public doesn't understand, you're absolutely right, because messages to the average person are so confusing out there. Mm-hmm. However, when you look at what has happened and what has been accomplished, I think, frankly, the guy has been extraordinary.
All right. Thank you very much, Julie. We just need to get a response here. Are you not maybe giving Obama some credit for accomplishing what he did despite the opposition?
Well, I thank the caller for her kind words and her call. And it's a matter of judgment. I wrote a book that I published last year called Kabuki Democracy, the System versus Barack Obama, still available. And I was very sympathetic to Obama in that book because I felt like it didn't really matter what he did. The system was so screwed up, so dominated by money and ideology and dysfunction in various ways that we needed to fix the system before we could blame the president for not using it more effectively. Since then, I've become much more critical of Obama. In other words, back then, I shared the view of the caller, and I argued for it. But since then, I've become much more critical of Obama because I feel like he's made a lot of compromises he didn't have to make. Maybe he did have to give up on the public option. But in terms of his budget negotiations, he's going much, much further in giving away the store, or trying to, than he needs to. And he's not standing firm for anything. He's cutting every deal available to him and some that aren't. So she may be right. I mean, Obama and his advisors would say she was right. That's basically their argument, and they may be right. But I think I would like to see our side fight harder. Their side fights very hard, and our side says, well, things are tough. This is the best we can do, and I'm not sure it is. I'd like to see that proven, if in fact it's true.
Our next caller is Shane in Rudolph. Hello, Shane.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to ask Mr. Altman quickly his thoughts on Ralph Nader. In my opinion, Ralph Nader is one of the few true liberal candidates we've seen in maybe a few decades on the presidential scene. And as far as I interpret what happened to him, he was railroaded by the Democratic Party in favor of a more neoliberal Al Gore. So in a world like this where, you know, even the Democratic Party tends to work against true liberal candidates, Should people who identify as liberals get behind Obama, just kind of deal with it, compromise a little bit, go neoliberal? Is that what we have to do?
You know, I've spent a lot of my life for the past few years dealing with proponents of Ralph Nader who hate me and think I'm one of the worst people in the world because I was one of the most critical people of Ralph Nader in the 2000 election and ever since. And there's a movie about Ralph Nader made by people who admire Ralph Nader, which I'm in, and I'm very critical of him. And every time the movie is shown, which is shown apparently quite a lot on Showtime, people email me and say what a jerk I am. But I think Ralph Nader is a terrible person. I don't think he's a liberal at all. I think he's a Leninist. I think he's one, and I think he wouldn't disagree with this. He's one of these people who thinks the system has to get a lot worse before it can get better. And so he purposely elected George Bush, did everything he could to elect George Bush in 2000, and he succeeded. And we got the Iraq War, and we got the attack on the environment, we got the attack on poor people, and that's all due to Ralph Nader's decision. People say, how can you blame Ralph Nader for the 2000 election? I say, well, on election night in 2000, there was only one person in the entire world who could have gone on television and say, we fought a good fight, we raised a lot of good issues, we'll be back, but this man is too dangerous to be president of the United States. Look at the terrible things he might do. And Ralph Nader didn't do that. He went back on his word that he would not campaign in battleground areas, taking money from people under false circumstances. I think he's a terrible person. I think he's what Lenin, again, I keep quoting Lenin, it's funny. He's a useful idiot. for the conservative side. And I've even become quite critical of Ralph Nader from the days when he was a liberal hero. I don't think he was a liberal hero. I think it was a mistake for liberals to use the courts to get what they to win their battles rather than trying to win them democratically. I think it ended up costing them a lot more than they gained. So I think Ralph Nader is a big net negative. I think that if he had done, look at the difference between what the conservatives and the Republican side did and the Naderites did on the liberal side. The conservatives took over the Republican Party and they ran primaries, and when they won those primaries, they would run their candidates. Sometimes they would win, sometimes they would lose. But now they control the Republican Party. Whereas, again, the leftists on the liberal side, they attacked the liberals. They ran a third-party candidate. They gave the country George Bush, and now they're whining. Stop whining. It's your choice. You elected this guy.
Shane, do you want a follow-up?
Yeah, I'm a little shocked at the implication that Ralph Nader is a terrible person. I mean, his career of public service, in my opinion, is exemplary. The guy's like the Mother Teresa of American politics, in my opinion. Whereas Barack Obama, you know, in 2008, he was outfunded by Wall Street compared to John McCain. Obama took more money from Wall Street. As a president, he brokered a compromise to extend the Bush tax cuts while the Congress was controlled by a Democratic majority. That shocked me. Those tax cuts would have expired if Obama hadn't brokered that deal. In my opinion, you know, he's a Republican in Democratic clothing. And we keep voting for guys like him. We end up with Republican policies. Maybe we deserve that.
Yeah, and Shane, Ralph Nader supposedly isn't running this year. What are you going to do?
You know, it's tough to figure out. On election day, you know, you only have two choices once it's that election day. But between now and then, what I'm going to do is keep the pressure up on the Democratic Party, you know, locally, of course, to do what's right, to fight for true democratic progressive values. In my opinion, the neoliberal school of thought is giving away the farm, and it's really frightening.
All right, this is the second caller now, too, that said that Obama is a neoliberal. Is that how you would describe him, Eric Alterman?
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. But I think it's our fault, not his fault. I mean, like I said, he should fight a little harder. But the fact is he's reflecting the system. Barack Obama did not want to extend the Bush tax cuts. The Democratic Party made him extend the Bush tax cuts, in part because the Democratic Party, as the caller implies, is funded by the same rich people that fund the Republican Party. And they wanted to keep their tax cuts. And they got particularly the ones who are vulnerable are the ones who were afraid that if they voted against him, then rich people would give all their money to the other side and they would lose their seats. So the problem is really money and the power of money in the system. And that's what we need to address. It's not Barack Obama is a good or a bad guy. It's the system is dysfunctional. But I have to say, Ralph Nader has made it much more dysfunctional with the role that he played in 2000 and his unwillingness to face up to that. You know what Barack Obama called, what Ralph Nader called Barack Obama? He called him an Uncle Tom for corporate America, quote unquote. Now, that to me is exactly what's wrong with people to the left of liberals. They're using this racist term, this divisive term, to address the individual who's up against this incredibly powerful force. How about fighting the powerful force in a smart and effective way instead of in a way that gets people like George Bush elected president?
Well, there are candidates, I know, because she was in Wisconsin recently, a Green Party candidate, Jill Stein. There are other third parties that might be considered left of liberal. That is, you don't think that's an option for voters, or that if voters go that route, it's gonna hurt liberalism in the long run?
Well, we don't have a proportional representation system. We have a winner take all system. In New York, we have a pretty good third party that's to the left of the Democrats. The Working Families Party, and they run progressive Democrats, and every once in a while they'll challenge one, but basically they try not to be destructive. Unfortunately, in this country, because of our winner-take-all system, and particularly in the Electoral College, you don't get anything for coming in second. And what the case with third parties, I'm not against them in principle, I'm against them as a practical matter. All they do is elect the bad guy, as Nader did in 2000. So I don't support, there's no, I don't know of any Green Party candidate I would support. I think the Green Party, people who vote for the Green Party, should take over the Democratic Party. I probably don't agree with, I probably don't disagree with them in terms of what kind of country they would like to see, most of them. But I think I'm a lot more practical-minded.
Eric Alterman is a distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College and CUNY Graduate School of Journalism, a columnist for The Nation, a regular contributor to The Daily Beast. He is also the author of The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism, From Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. And we're talking about this fight for American liberalism. And welcoming your questions, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's about 14 minutes before 9 o'clock on this Monday, April the 16th. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you. And after 10, Facebook announced a $1 billion purchase of Instagram last week and expects to set records with its initial public offering next month. So business is great for Facebook, but how are we? Kathleen will talk with a guest about loneliness, happiness, and Facebook, coming up after 10. We are talking with the author of The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism, From Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama, Eric Alterman. Eric Alterman is also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, the Nation Institute, and the World Policy Institute. And before we go back to the phones, what is needed to change or to revive liberalism as a force in American politics, Eric Alterman?
Well, the simple answer to that is that only 17% of Americans trust the government to do the right thing some or most of the time, most or all of the time today. And as long as that number is that low, liberalism will be in bad shape. We need to get that number up to 50, more than 50%. Because you can't have liberalism without a strong government. And in order for that to happen, liberals have to stop apologizing and trying to sound like conservatives. They have to speak their minds and say what they believe and make a forceful argument for their beliefs in a way that very few national liberals have done, since the election of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. And how did the word liberal take on such a negative connotation?
Well, liberals made a bunch of mistakes in the 1960s and didn't own up to them. So it's partially liberals' own fault. But most of the reason has been that conservatives have invested a fortune in demonizing liberals, in demonizing the word and turning the quote-unquote L word into a four-letter word. That's why I work for the Center for American Progress instead of the Center for American Liberalism. Progressive is still a good word, and politicians are happy to call themselves that, but they're afraid of the word liberal. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, neither one would call themselves a liberal in the 2008 election, whereas all of the Republicans call themselves conservatives. So there's a big problem there. And again, it's a matter of fighting back.
Yeah, and conservatives today will call President Obama a socialist, or a Republican Congress member will accuse Democratic Congress members of being communists.
Yeah, well, the word, to a lot of people, the word liberal means socialist or communist, again, because liberals have not fought back. So, that's like, if you don't appear to have confidence in your own beliefs, you can't expect other people to trust you. And that's been, I think, maybe the central problem for liberals.
Tom in Burlington is with us now. Hello, Tom.
Yes, maybe the liberals haven't been able to sell themselves to the people. Talking about FDR, FDR didn't put his sort of radical programs into effect until after he had solved the problems, the economic problems that were facing him right away. And I think that's one of the mistakes Mr. Obama made. He didn't face up. He didn't do the housing problem was never dealt with correctly and focused on, and we still have it. We have 11 million people facing losing their homes, and the problem now with the energy, he really should have done something about the energy problem. We have these high gas prices now. We have no comprehensive energy program at all, and if we really got together and worked on it, we could, each and every one of us could solve that problem. And now there's a lag. When the price of gas goes up for 6 months from now, it's going to affect the economy, and the economy is not going to be in good shape. There's no way it possibly can be in the next 6 months because of this spike in energy prices, and that, of course, will give the opposition a chance to use that, and maybe Mr. Romney will win simply because of that.
All right. Tom, thanks very much for the input. Certainly a reaction, I guess, to Tom's concerns or thoughts, but I'm wondering if you do have sort of a comparison of how Barack Obama dealt with an economic crisis, a near depression, and FDR, and how he dealt with a Great Depression.
Well, Franklin Roosevelt had a much stronger hand to play than Barack Obama. The collapse of the economy made his enemies much weaker, and he had a much, much stronger working majority of Congress than Obama did. And so he was able to get his programs through much more easily. Obama, you know, the Republicans were standing in the way of everything Obama did. If he wanted to get a drink of water, you know, they would filibuster it. And the Democrats were very divided between conservative Democrats and centrist and liberal Democrats. So he couldn't do what needed to be done. They wouldn't let him. And so this is what my book, Kabuki Democracy, was about. So I agree with the caller that it would have been better if he had dealt with housing first and the banks first. But it was really hard to do. They were still very strong. He didn't end up dealing with them very effectively at all in the end. And people, you know, what Obama would say, and he would have a very good case, is that the economy was in such a state of crisis that we didn't have the opportunity anymore to do the things we wanted to do. We just had to deal with the crisis. The boat was sinking. You know, we couldn't redecorate it. And in fact, the crisis was worse than we knew. The economy was contracting at a rate of 3.8%, not 1.9%, as everybody thought at the time. So I think that's a pretty good argument, and I don't think we should forget it. But, you know, it's very hard to be president. My problem with Obama is not in his judgment. It's in his willingness to take some hits and to reveal which side he's on. His whole political persona since he became president is about getting along with the other side and ending the dissension of the Bush era. And that would be fine if there were another side to get along with. But the other side has no interest in that. So every time he turns the other cheek, he gets slapped again. And it's time he got up off the canvas and fought back.
Did you think he was fighting back at all when he responded to the Republican budget, Wisconsin Congressman Paul Ryan's budget, by calling it thinly veiled social Darwinism?
You know, he says things like that, but more importantly, he says it's not class warfare, it's math. You know, he shouldn't call it math. He should call it fairness. He should say they're conducting class warfare and we're fighting back. And he does call, you know, he does call the Ryan budget names, but he's happy to compromise on the basis of the Ryan budget. When he was negotiating with John Boehner, He was giving away the store far more than even the Democrats in Congress would have been willing to. He would have had to sell that package to them too. So I don't see the rhetoric, unless it's backed by actual programs, doesn't interest me anymore.
Josie in Sheboygan. Hello, Josie.
Good morning. I'm very disappointed with President Obama because, like you, and I do agree with your guest with most of what he says, because the people he took on in his administration, like Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, were two of the most awful picks he ever could have picked, because Timothy Geithner was the president of the Federal Reserve in New York, and he had the power to stop those billions of dollars and actually stop the recession before it even began with all the fraud. He knew what was going on. He was an ultimate absolute failure in that, and yet he took him on in his administration. I just don't understand that. It's so awful.
Do you understand it, Eric Alterman?
Well, I agree with the first part of what the caller said. He did pick Geithner and Summers. He didn't pick Paul Krugman or Joseph Stiglitz. Had he done that, it would have made all the difference in terms of the kinds of policies he pursued. But that's who he is. Now, I didn't realize that. I knew that was a part of who he was during 2008. But that's who he is. That's what he believes. He's an establishment guy. He goes with the guys who have the technocratic knowledge, not the guys who are speaking on behalf of particular values, particularly liberal values. So, that's a function of what our political system has produced. And if we want a president who would pick Paul Krugman, say, as the chair of the Federal Reserve, we need to produce that president. And we didn't in Barack Obama.
Our next caller, maybe our last caller, is Ellen in Milwaukee. Hello, Ellen.
Hello there. Get money out of politics. That's all I've got to say. I think we need a constitutional convention. We need to get rid of what the Supreme Court has done to our country. And Feingold and McCain tried to fix it, and other people have tried to fix it, and now the Supreme Court has completely overturned it. And we're not going to have the kind of government anyone wants, except the conservatives, until we fix that huge flaw in our system. And we need liberals, progressives, to get out there and fight for what they want. They need to say it. They need to not be ashamed.
Thank you very much, Ellen. You agree with that, Eric Alterman?
Amen, sisters. All I can say. To that.
Well, what is your hope of that happening? Getting money out of politics?
Impossible. Literally impossible. Politics has always been about money, but it doesn't have to be as much about money as it is in this country. This country is dysfunctional in that respect compared to other democracies, and it is the fault of the Supreme Court, and that's a very tough fight to win. It'll take decades. In the meantime, we need to try and improve things with public financing and other methods, which are very hard to pass these days, too. But she's right. The problem is that the Supreme Court has decided that corporations have the same speech rights as people, that money is speech, and that it can't be regulated. And so long as that is true, when we talk about the country and our democracy, we're really talking about money. And, rich people have a lot more money than everybody else, and so they get a lot more of what they want from politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll leave it there. We're out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Eric Alterman is author of The Cause, The Fight for American Liberalism from Franklin Roosevelt to Barack Obama. Thanks to Rob Ferret, to Bill Martins, and to Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. Lots more to come here on the Ideas Network. And tomorrow at this time, we will have another edition of On Your Money. Financial planner Kevin McKinley is going to be in, and we'll have him answer your personal finance questions. On Your Money, tomorrow at this time. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.